From New Orleans, this is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Nicholas Payton puts everything he has into his music. Intellect, outrage, tenderness, romance, hope, humor. He can play all that and more on the trumpet. His lips are tough.
Look at Louis Armstrong's chops. Miles Davis is scarred. My lips are scarred. These are battle scars. It's an instrument of war. You know, this is the instrument, the end of the world, Gabriel and all of this. These are big shoes to fill.
But Payton swings a variety of other instruments. For him, conventional trumpet solos are not enough.
That's boring, just standing up. You play a solo and then you walk to the side, play a solo. Now I get to be a part of the music the whole time, which is much more fulfilling to me.
Nicholas Payton in War and Peace, after the break. Nicholas Payton reserves the right to play more than one instrument at the same time, in different keys, while singing. That's because he's Nicholas Payton, and he's a hellfire musician from New Orleans. He's a Grammy Award-winning trumpet player, but he also plays electric keyboard, bass, and 17 other instruments. 17! As a band leader, he's released a dozen albums. He's a composer, a producer, a sideman, and a record label owner. He's also a contrarian who writes blog posts about the music business that will shrink the loins of many a jazz record executive. It's clear that after more than 30 years in music, Payton has something of value to say, in print and on record. Nicholas Payton joins us here at Marini Studios. So happy this finally happened.
Good to be here, Gwen. How you doing today?
Doing very well, thank you.
If I may make an edit before we start, because I've taken issue with a lot of words used as descriptors for me, but I don't view myself as a polemic or a contrarian, as a word. I think what it is, because contrarian to me connotes that regardless of what the view, the public view is, I try to stand in opposition. It just so happens that most of the things that are before us, I stand in opposition of. Because I think the status quo and the whole purpose of it is to suppress and oppress people. And my goal is to liberate people through my art form.
Well, okay, we're going to talk about that.
Cool.
Okay, that works.
Yeah, just want to put that out there. Yeah.
Okay, so let's get this out of the way first, okay? How is it possible to play trumpet and keyboard simultaneously? I mean, this seems to be more like a feat more than coordination.
Yeah, it's a lot of things going on, because one is two instruments, two different textures. One you're blowing, you know, one is like touch-based, one is a string instrument, one is a wind instrument. So there's a whole headspace thing going on. Then you're in two keys at one time, and you're doing two different things at one time. But, you know, we're often doing, like, a lot of things at one time, right? Like, when we're driving, we're using our sight. We're using our hearing to, you know, are there other cars in the way? We're using our motor skills. Music is forward motion, too. It's driving, too. It's getting from point A to point B.
You know, I I remember the drummer Levon Helm, who played with the band so famously, and he, you know, people would always ask him, how do you sing and drum at the same time? You know, that seems awfully hard. And he would say, well, it's actually easier because as the drummer, I control the timing. You know what I mean? And so I can always make space for me to say something.
That's true. But I tell you, Gwen, when I first started doing it, because I grew up just playing all the instruments. Both of my parents are musicians. My mom plays piano. My dad played bass and sousaphone and was a famed musician in his own right.
Yeah, the great Walter Payton.
Yeah. So I just grew up around music. And then, you know, I got to a point where I couldn't find a keyboardist, and I had some great ones, to do what I wanted to hear, you know? And I just said, well, I should try to do it myself, you know? So I just did. I was like the left hand here, comping and holding up the trumpet with my right hand. And in some sense, it's no different than what a pianist does when they solo, right? However, it's at least in the same key and they're playing the same instrument with the same virtual function.
But let me ask you this. I mean, I hate to sound like a union boss, but are you denying a job to a poor pianist on stage who might be able to get what you want?
Well, if he can play what I want to hear, then I would gladly hire him because that would make my job easier. And I've still been looking. I just haven't found it yet.
Well, maybe the problem is when you said he, maybe there's a she out there.
That's true. That's true. And my sexism slips out every now and then. That is true. He or she. And I've been known to hire a lot of she's.
So. Yes, you have been, yeah. And so, but you came to prominence as a young musician playing trumpet.
Mm-hmm.
But you have also said lately that playing a melody, taking trumpet solos, and standing on the side of the stage for a majority of the show just felt boring after a while.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a view that's commonly held among musicians?
I don't know if it is, but I certainly felt it.
You were bored.
Just like, that's boring, just standing up, you play a solo and then you walk to the side, play a solo. Now I get to be a part of the music the whole time, which is much more fulfilling to me.
It's interesting that you should say that because I do sense that there are more musicians who are trying to change the dynamic on stage, you know? So for instance, a few years ago, I was at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival and I saw John Batiste and his band, what is it, Stay Human, performing. And they were like birds flying around that stage. I mean, everyone was constantly in motion to the point where it was difficult to figure out what the heck was going on. But I was excited, you know, watching that. Do you see your stage presence, that would be you and whoever you're playing with, as evolving? And if it is evolving, to what is it evolving, do you think?
Absolutely. I can't answer to what because there's yet to be a period on the end of that sentence. But absolutely. And a lot of things have contributed to that, not only me bringing my multi-instrumentalism into play, which has always been the case. But early on, I was just focused on being a trumpeter. And knowing the market, like, it's hard enough to just do that. I wanted to firmly establish that before I just started venturing off. And I would sneak it in every now and then, like play a little keys on a track here and there on the album. Like I think the first album I did that was Nick at Night. I played like celeste on a track or harpsichord. And then on Dear Lewis, I snuck in the Rhodes. Because, you know, you just have to understand as an artist that people only have the capacity maybe to withstand so much information at one time. And that's your job as an artist to introduce it in a way that is not jarring and upsetting to people while still remaining true to who you are.
Right. It's like introducing your new girlfriend at Thanksgiving dinner with the rest of your family, right?
Right, when they still know
the old one.
Yeah, it's like,
what happened to Sheila?
Yeah, yeah. And you don't want nobody to say that right in front of you. So you got to sneak it in, you know?
Exactly.
Maybe don't do it at Thanksgiving. Do it at the Sunday dinner first or something.
It's true.
Don't do it at Christmas.
No, you know? Do not do it at Christmas.
You know?
we single you out for doing this, but, you know, there's so many multi-instrumentalists, as you say. And, you know, I think about Charles Mingus, for instance, the bassist. Mm-hmm. But I love his piano work.
I love that. That's like my favorite Mingus album, actually.
Really?
The one he plays piano.
I love it, too. Yeah.
There's something really honest about that, that I sort of just can relate to in a certain way. No disrespect to his bass playing or composition, but that's my favorite Mingus album because it's like, that's real art.
That's bassist Charles Mingus with Body and Soul from the 1963 album Mingus Plays Piano. We're talking to yet another multi-instrumentalist, Nicholas Payton. Coming up, what's the first sign that a child is a musical prodigy? Stay with us. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Nicholas Payton often works alone, but his collaborations are compelling. Here he is with Cassandra Wilson.
You take me places I've never been before. Says I've never been before. Never been by plane.
Okay, that is one wonderful song.
Thank you.
Oh, my goodness. And, I mean, talk about, you know, the ultimate in control. You are the songwriter, and you got Cassandra Wilson to sing a song that says how wonderful it is to make love with you.
Not bad.
But, not bad at all.
But it's interesting how that came about. It was a barter.
Barter?
Yeah. What happened was I was working on my album in Piety Street Studios right up the street from here.
Yeah, here in New Orleans. Mm-hmm.
And she was in Studio A, I was in Studio B, and we were passing each other, hi, you know. And she kept saying, hey, Nicholas, I'm doing my album over here. You should, like, jump on the track or whatever. I'm just thinking she's trying to be nice, whatever. She's like, no, I was like, you really want me to play on something? She's like, yeah, I want you to play on it. I'm like, okay. So we go in the control room and she plays a song. It's a song called Lover Come Back to Me. And she's like, cool, you want to do something on it? I'm like, cool, fine. So they cue up the track and I go in the studio. They set my mics up, whatever, and she's off talking to her friend or something like that. And I do a take or whatever and I knock it out. So beautiful, thank you so much. I was like, no, it was my honor. She was like, so yeah, how much you want for it? I was like, I don't want your money, but I was like, I'm working on an album. I'll do this one for you for free. Would you do a song on my album? in exchange, and that's how that came about.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Wow. That's what you call fair trade in the music business, right? There's something about that sound that the two of you all have. It's almost as if you are physically touching. You know?
That's the point of the song. It's like two lovers maybe in this life who there's a kinship and a relationship that existed before them seeing each other in the physical in this life. That's kind of what the song is about.
The way you touch my heart, the way you touch my soul.
It's one of those songs that wrote itself. Like, I don't write music. I stopped writing music in like 2002. All my songs, they write themselves. And the actual written part of it is maybe the last part that I go through when I have to disseminate the piece to the musicians so they can play it. But some of my songs I have never even physically written out at all. I hear things, you know, could be a melody, a rhythm, a series of chords, what have you. I record it. For the last 10 years or so, it's been on my iPhone. Like, I have quite a reservoir of songs, and to the point where, like, if I never wrote a song again, which I hope isn't the case, but if I never wrote a song again, I'm good.
This is Music Inside Out. We're talking with trumpet virtuoso and multi-instrumentalist Nicholas Payton. You seem to have been born to play music. You picked up a trumpet at the age of 4. Do you remember that far back?
I do. I remember, because actually, it's not well known, but I played violin before that. Briefly, I started on Suzuki violin. Those are my formal lessons. And I just didn't like the violin. I mean, it wasn't cool to walk around with a violin where I lived.
So, you grew up in the Sixth Ward.
Yeah,
you grew up in Treme. How is it not cool to have a violin?
No, it wasn't cool. But actually, at that time, we were living uptown on Louisiana Parkway.
Okay.
We didn't move to the Treme until I was 8. But still, you know, it's viewed as like a girly instrument. Not that anything's wrong with being a girl, but, you know, as a boy, like, I wasn't into it.
Okay, so you got the trumpet.
It was cooler.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, it was cooler. And so, I mean, what's your earliest memory of you in the trumpet?
My dad bought me, I asked him for it. Like, it wasn't like he gave me a trumpet. I was like, Dad, I want to play the trumpet. Something about that instrument just really appealed to my spirit. And it could have been like this town being, you know, sort of a brass town. Yeah, the birthplace of so many of the greatest trumpeters who ever lived. And I grew up watching and hearing and listening to, even in my very own living room, like Teddy Riley and Clyde Kerr Jr. and Wendell Brunius and Leroy Jones. These were all my dad's friends.
Great trumpet players.
You know, my dad used to play at the Maison Bourbon with the great Thomas Jefferson. Just hearing that power, there's just a stately, regal thing to the trumpet that just calls your attention, that just really just said, like, this, it just appealed to my sensibilities.
Well, how long did it take for you to get a sound out of that trumpet?
I'm still, I mean, it is the most difficult instrument, you know, and we probably have like the shortest life expectancy rate of any instrument. People like Doc Cheatham, who play into their 90s, they're anomalies. Like, it's a very hard instrument to play. I mean, it's a very unnatural thing. First of all, you're blowing compressed air through a tube and have metal up to one of the most sensitive parts of your body, on your lips.
Your lips, exactly. And, you know, and the wrong embouchure can ruin everything.
Even the right one. Like, you look a great trumpet player. Look at Louis Armstrong's chops. Miles Davis is scarred. My lips are scarred. These are battle scars. It's an instrument of war. You know, this is the instrument, the end of the world, Gabriel, and all of this. These are big shoes to fill.
Yeah.
You know, so when we think about this instrument, it's a call to arms. It's serious business. But it's something about it. And as strong and brash as it can be that vulnerable and tender and sensitive. So I love the wide dynamic range of it. I felt like I can really paint and craft the type of pictures that I want, multi-layered pictures on this one instrument.
Okay.
You know?
And so at what point did the people around you, and perhaps even you, understand that you were a child prodigy on trumpet?
I don't know if it was even so much on a trumpet, but very early on it was detected that there was something there. My dad used to love to tell this story. I think I was about 3, and they were having a rehearsal at the house and a lot of heavyweights in the room. And they were trying to take a song off of an album, and they couldn't figure out this one chord. And apparently I walked over to my little toy piano at 3 years old and laid my hand down on it and was like, that's it, that's the chord.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Man, so. That's like something out of a Cecil B. DeMille movie or something. You know? Ooh, the child just come with the hand on the cord. You know, that's pretty fantastic.
There it is.
And so now, obviously, your dad was the wonderful bassist, Walter Payton. He was a music teacher as well. He played R&B, played funk, he played traditional New Orleans music, he played with Alan Toussaint, he played traditional music with Preservation Hall and in brass bands. So, and your mom, as you say, was a piano player, but also, was she also an opera singer?
Yeah, she studied opera at Xavier University. She was also the pianist at St. Jude Church on Rampart. I have a distant relative, Henry Payton. He was a luthier. He made string instruments.
Yes.
And was a peer of Buddy Bolden.
And may
I play with him? Yeah, so.
Buddy Bolden is, you know, to a lot of minds, Buddy Bolden is the source from which all this music comes. That's incredible that you can trace your family to Buddy Bolden. You know, we were talking to the great Herlin Riley, the drummer.
I heard that interview.
Oh, man, actually. He was great. Mm-hmm. And when he said, oh, yeah, my grandfather played with Louis Armstrong in the Colored Waves home, I dang near dropped my pen. I couldn't believe it. It's amazing how deep the roots go in this town.
It's not so coincidental, you know? Themes of, like, energy and ancestry and lineage, so important to this music. And to Black people in particular, when we were brought here during the transatlantic slave trade, we were not allowed to speak our native languages. So I think this music becomes important because we developed a new language in the blues and places like Congo Square, you know, which was one of the only, if not the only place in North America where the enslaved Africans could continue their drumming and dancing and music rituals and connect with their ancestry and their lineage and bring a part of their home and who they were as Africans here. The energy of spaces like that created many, many years later a Buddy Bolden and a King Oliver and a Louis Armstrong, who is really the first king of pop.
Right, right. Yeah. And so, but going back to your household, though, as you say, you moved from, I guess, uptown New Orleans to the Sixth Ward, to Treme, when you were, what, how old would you say?
Eight. Yeah.
Are you an only child?
No, I had a younger brother.
And so tell us a little bit more. What did you hear when you were a young kid in that house? What did your house sound like?
I heard some of the greatest music in the world. I heard people were prodigies before they became stars and household names. I heard Harry Connick, you know, and saw him, you know, when he was just a kid. You know, my father is actually on his first album that was released later called 11. I remember Professor Longhair coming to pay my father a visit and just playing our piano.
No way.
And me just going under the piano and just letting that sound hit me. I love to sit under the piano.
I heard he used to kick the piano, though.
He didn't kick me. maybe I was smart enough to stay away from them pedals. but I just love to be under the piano and let the acoustics hit me. Ellis Marsalis was in our house, the great Ed Frank, Eddie Collins. The greatest musicians in the city were in my living room, and they would pass by all hours of the night, play, talk, hang.
Mm-hmm.
then growing up in the Treme, you know, James Black lived like around the corner. Yeah, right around the corner from us. He liked to play our grand, so sometimes he would come over and work ideas. I have manuscripts from James Black tunes no one has ever heard.
Is that right?
That he just left on our piano. Yeah. First song I remember hearing, and I'm sure I heard songs before. I was at somebody's birthday party. I was 3 years old, and it was 1976, and it was Sir Duke.
Oh, wow, Stevie Wonder.
Yeah, and when I heard that, I was like, what is that sound? All that bass. I remember walking right over to the speakers and just letting all that bass hit me.
Music is a world within itself.
You know, I mean, but you, after your grand debut, you know, I mean, as the kid with the great ear for chords back when you were four, you know, you went to work fairly early in life. I mean, you were working with a couple of brass bands before you were 10.
I'll tell you a funny story. My dad, once he saw the interest and I started gigging, he began bringing me like to clubs to sit in with various people. And I remember being about 12. The Dirty Dozen was playing at Snug Harbor.
Oh, nice.
And they called me up to sit in. And this is really jive that they did this that I think about it now. They were like, okay, yeah, let's play Donna Lee. I don't know if you know Donna Lee, but that's a hard song.
How does it go?
I mean, I know professional musicians who don't know the melody correctly right now. They called a 12-year-old kid to play that. And you know what? I nailed it.
Yay!
Why did I know it? Because my dad was shedding on that song back in 1976. I remember the Jaco Pastorius debut album had came out.
Yes.
And every bass player had to learn that.
That's right.
So again, prepping me for things later, I knew it already. I already knew it.
Oh, my goodness. So you're saying that you were like an aficionado of Jaco Pastorius, of Weather Report, and of course on his own, before you reached puberty?
Basically, yes. In fact, at 12 years old, I was already playing trumpet. My dad, for my 12-year-old Christmas, bought me an electric bass, and I was learning Jaco solos.
Hearing Jaco Pastorius with Donna Lee and talking with multi-instrumentalist Nicholas Payton. Coming up, what's wrong with the word jazz? Stay tuned. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out. When Nicholas Payton heard this song by Miles Davis, he knew he wanted to play music for the rest of his life. The song is called Four, and it was recorded live at Lincoln Center. Okay, now there are two albums that came out of that session that's 60. Was it 60? What was it?
64.
64 session at
My
Lincoln
Funny
Center.
Valentine.
It was that one, right?
And four. Which was this one.
And then My Funny Valentine, like you said, right? Mm-hmm. And which is more ballads and sort of mid-tempo songs and stuff. Why are you drawn to the straight-ahead stuff, the fast stuff?
Well, I was young, right? I'm a kid, so all these high notes and runs that just appealed to my 12-year-old sensibility. I wasn't yet ready for the ballads.
Oh,
that
there
came. That came later.
That comes later. Well, you know, Nick Lowe, the songwriter Nick Lowe, who I like so much, he said, when you're young, you want to rock. Mm-hmm. And when you're old, you want to roll. But, you know, in 2013, you did something that even Miles Davis had not done, or at least not recorded, and that was that you recorded Sketches of Spain live, okay, with an orchestra, okay, in Switzerland. Why is performing Sketches of Spain so difficult? To do it live, all in one take, so difficult?
I mean, it's just... It's and I've never done one, but it's what I imagine, like, running a marathon is. Like, you have the trumpet to your face virtually the whole time. Whereas, you know, like, in a standard quintet situation, okay, you take a blazing solo or whatever, but then you stand to the side, as we've discussed. There's no breaks, really. A couple bars here and there, but you have the horn to your face the whole time.
Don Vappi, he once quoted Clyde Kerr Jr., you know, the wonderful instructor who was playing traditional music for a while, and he said, this music ain't got no rest. Said that the last song, is it called Solia?
I think
Solia
so. Yeah.
Is like climbing a mountain.
It is
a 12 plus minute song.
Yeah, because you got a crescendo to deal with, and everybody's waiting for it, and it don't come to the end. So you really gotta pace yourself. If you waste your wad early, you're not gonna make it. So you really have to steadily pace yourself, and that's where maturity comes in. Because, you know, the 12-year-old Nicholas, I might have just whatever in the first, you know, part of the section, and then you don't have nowhere to go.
Yeah. Yeah,
so
that's true.
So I had to do that in my 30s because it's difficult, and it's just difficult to do, period. So here's the thing about that. If that wasn't enough, that's something to stand and to play for 40 to 45 minutes with the horn to your face at one time. That's a pretty big feat. But then after that, we took a 15, 20 minute break, and then we played my whole Black American Symphony after that. Who does that? But again, you know, it's about pushing yourself. Like, you have to push your body to do things that you don't know you can do or that you can't do if you're gonna be better.
So what were you trying to do with the Black American Symphony?
I was striving to expose that Black music can be symphonic without necessarily catering to a European aesthetic. I think oftentimes if people try to say, and another reason why I don't like the term jazz is because people want to say, well, it's African rhythms and European harmony. Like, Europeans, all due respect, invented harmony. No, they didn't. Harmony exists in nature. The overtone series is harmonic, and that's just a scientific thing without an instrument played. And I really wanted to revel in a sound that I associate, or sounds that I associate with being Black. For instance, in classical music, they use a dominant 7 chord, but typically the dominant 7 chord was always a passing chord. Like you would go, that's a C dominant 7 chord. That's the root of the blues. You have that flat 7. You have a minor 3rd. So you have all the notes and all the intervals that make up what the blues are. But for us, for the blues, that's a resting chord. We can just stay there.
Mm-hmm.
From Jelly Roll Morton's Jungle Blues. James Brown, Cold Sweat. It's the same thing. That's home for us.
Okay.
So whereas in European music, that is a chord to get from here to there. For us, that is the tonic. That is the root. That is home.
That's
so it's
home.
Same notes, different function. Therefore, to me, not the same chord. Also performing it in September in Colorado, the U.S. debut.
Danced around this, but what's the harm of using the term jazz?
Depends on what you define as harm. For me, just the word itself is of dubious origin. Every synonym is negative.
Okay, you're pulling out your phone right now. Are you looking?
I'm gonna look.
All right, let's look. Where are you looking?
So here's Merriam-Webster's synonyms for jazz.
Okay.
Applesauce, balderdash, baloney, beans, bills, blah, blarney, blather, blither, bosh, bull, bunk, bunkum, claptrap, codswallop, crapola, crock, drivel, drool, fiddle, fiddle faddle, fiddle sticks, flannel, flap doodle, folderall, folly, foolishness, fudge, garbage, guff, hogwash, hokey pokey, hokum, hoodoo, hooey, horse feathers, humbug, humbuggery, nonsense, malarkey, moonshine, muck, nerts, nuts, piffle, poppycock, punk, rot, rubbish, senselessness, silliness, slush, stupidity, taradiddle, tommyrot, tosh, trash, trumpery, twaddle.
Okay, that's quite a list. And so that's from the thesaurus.
This is from Merriam-Webster.
Okay, and so and at no point does it mention music?
Yes, it probably says something about music, but I don't think you'll ever escape this negative connotation people have with jazz or the music. If we look at jazz right now, it is often marginalized. We look at jazz festivals, and there's very little jazz to speak of. Or we look at how much the jazz artists get paid versus the other artists, it's always less. It's okay if there are only 2 to 3 people in a jazz club, which in any other successful business model, that would be unacceptable. Jazz is at the bottom of the charts. Jazz is often not on air on the Grammys. The jazz happens in the pre-telecast. Then it's, we don't want to hear this music. It's boring. You want to go see some jazz. Oh, no, I want to go have fun. I worked hard all week. Or I don't want to have to think.
Okay, let me ask you this, though, or say this. You know, for many of the reasons that you're describing, there seems to be like a reputation that jazz musicians have developed over the years of being snobby and also of arguing among themselves to the detriment of the music's attractiveness to larger audiences.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do you say to that?
I say those are both forces that serve to marginalize not only the artist, but to keep other people away from it. And that's what I fight against. I want my music to be enjoyable on as many levels as my listeners are. Hey, if you want to come to my gig and talk to the person next to you and get up and dance and not listen to us and have a good time, that's fine with me. I'm not a fan of the jazz elitism. I want away from that. And I attribute a lot of that to my roots here in New Orleans. A lot of times, hey, yeah, the band is great, but you know, it's really about the people out there.
Right.
The guy out there dancing, whatever, they may be the star. The woman over here in that fly dress or whatever, she may be the star. I'm happy to have my music as a part of the ceremonial proceedings. And I think the whole jazz thing where you have to listen and be quiet and look at us like museum pieces, that actually makes me very uncomfortable.
So let me ask you about Afro-Caribbean Mixtape, which is an album that came out, I believe, in 2017, in which you are using audio from a number of Black musicians and also Black theorists. And it's sort of woven into the beats and the grooves and the melodies that you've created.
We hope the information presented in this hour allows you to see all African culture Did not die.
You excerpt these fellas talking about this music. I think in terms of Dizzy Gillespie, he talks about it in terms of worship, you know. Then you have Art Blakey, for instance, you know, talking about this as a Black American music that emanates from New Orleans. Are you making it into a political work of art, or are you looking to make it into something else?
Hey, as somebody once said, as a Black person, everything you do in this country is political.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, but it's my most overtly political album. But I would say all of my albums are political.
They're all political.
Yeah. But this is the one that all the things that I've written and spoken about for so many years, I was able to place in conjunction to the music. I was able, through these voices you mentioned, to bring them together so that the music and the words and other people's words to back up that I'm just not pulling this out of thin air. There's a whole tradition of people saying this. So I'm not the first. I'm just continuing and maybe bringing this conversation to a new generation who perhaps is not familiar.
Interesting. And so in that role, do you think of yourself as a teacher?
I guess so, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the response that you get. Yeah, tell me about that.
I mean, I guess the overwhelming majority of people, I guess, perhaps get it, or maybe they don't. I don't know. I guess, you know, I don't know if I'm too results-based. I just know there's been an incredible amount of backlash to me saying it. That makes what I'm saying about BAM that much more important. I was saying that 7 years ago.
BAM is Black American Music.
That's an acronym for Black American Music.
Okay,
yes,
an acronym. Yes.
Yes.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So yeah, that makes it all that more important. Like, this is at risk of not being our music anymore. The whole of it.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, well, I mean, I'm not saying it because I don't believe it. I'm saying it because I'm surprised. You know,
But why should we be surprised? Like, this is colonization. We don't own major labels, right? Universal, Columbia, Warner Brothers, all the major labels that exist. They are white-run institutions. They always have been. We don't control the economics around the music.
So your company, Paytone Records.
Yes.
Did you form your company as an effort to step away from what you consider to be a white oppressive recording industry?
In some senses, yes, that is right. But here's the thing. I can't talk about black ownership and black business and black music without therefore establishing my own black corporation.
And so when you think about Paytone Records and the future of Paytone Records, are you hoping that you'll be able to bring others on board, other artists, that you can be of service to them, you know what I mean, to provide safe haven from, you know what I mean, from environments that that for the reasons that you describe are not necessarily healthy?
I hope so, but I have to solidly get my feet firmly first. Right now, it's me. And I've not really had a Paytones release yet, other than my own.
Oh, you mean another release of another artist?
Yes.
Okay, and so, it you know, you've done these three albums before the Afro-Caribbean mixtape. Mm-hmm. They were Numbers, Letters, and Textures, mm-hmm. right? And some of these songs you have described as unfinished in a way. That they're open enough for other people to insert themselves, you know, artistically on the records, like mm-hmm. Hip hop artists, for instance, or DJs, or perhaps other musicians.
We have these things as musicians, play along records, which are just that. It's the rhythm section without the soloist, so we can practice too. So in some instance, I was like, and by default of me not playing these solos, I would have created one of the hippest play-along records ever.
That's true. But it's also that there's a very interesting double entendre going on, two numbers. You know what I mean? Like a number is a number, a number is a song.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? A letter is a letter, but then there are letters that are that speak to literature, that speak to the written word. You know what I mean?
And oftentimes in music, there's an A section, a B section. When we look at sheet music, the sections are labeled letters. So that was also a part of the thinking. Another part of the thinking was in terms of this BAM idea.
Black American music?
Yeah. Reclaiming and establishing your own lexicon. So because numbers and letters are part of the foundation of what we use fundamentally to express ourselves, vocabulary, we use math and words and numbers. And I'm reestablishing these basic building blocks of what the foundation of our thought processes are. So that's why I have the graphic of the baby girl on the cover of Letters
with the
trumpet, with the blocks.
Yeah, she's got the little lettered blocks. Yeah.
I'm reestablishing a black lexicon, if I may, to get to a space where, you know what, we can create our own form of dialogue and communication.
You know, I saw you perform recently at the Prime Example, that jazz club, not far from here, actually. You know, this is a club that is in a part of town that not a lot of tourists come to. It's a lot of the people in there seem like they were from around there. And it seemed as if the music and the groove was something that to them was refreshing. You know, in thinking about jazz. I'm sorry, I know that you don't care for that term. I'm sorry. When thinking about this form of music, you know.
And I want as many people to hear my music as possible. Mm. But I'm also not going to dumb down what I do for the sake of popularity. So it's a fine balance, you know. I also want to give the people what they want. And that's what I think is so beautiful about Louis Armstrong, is that he had all the virtuosity, all the intellectual headspace to satisfy the musicians, and he could appeal to the common person.
Exactly.
That's the real brilliance. The person who can make these very lofty, high-minded ideals palatable to the common listener. That should be the goal.
And so what song would you like to leave us with?
Oh, my.
You got plenty.
I guess since we've been talking about it, jazz is a four-letter word.
Of course that's the one.
Bring it on home.
Well, I tell you, Nicholas Payton, it's been a real treat talking to you. I have looked forward to this for a long, long time.
Likewise.
Nicholas Payton.
This and that.
And you've been listening to Music Inside Out. Our show is produced by Lynette Johnson, Asher Griffith, Paul McDonald, Flawn Williams, Margaret Howes, and Justin Armstrong. Music Inside Out was produced in partnership with WWNO. For a complete playlist of the songs in this hour, go to our website at musicinsideout.org. And don't forget to like us on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.
Major support for Music Inside Out comes from the Historic New Orleans Collection. Music Inside Out also receives support from the Ruth U. Fertel Foundation, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, the Pinkalope Foundation, Baba Jim Istanbul Studios and Mastering, Adam Newman Designs, Shop Nadine Blake, and WWNO. Donations to Music Inside Out are tax deductible, thanks to our partnership with National Performance Network. For more information about how you can support our program, please go to our website at musicinsideout.org/support.